This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran rejects claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. Israeli forces clash with protesters holding a fresh rally in Tel Aviv to protest the policies of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Also ahead, China announces a rise in its annual military budget amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Iran has rejected claims about granting the International Atomic Energy Agency access to individuals as part of its inspections of the country's nuclear program. The spokesman for the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran says the issue was not even raised during the visit by the IAEA chief Rafael Grossi to Tehran. Behruz Kamalvandi added that there was also no discussion about unrestricted access to the alleged three undeclared locations where the agency claims to have found uranium traces. He also stressed that Iran's agreement with the IAEA during Grossi's visit complies with a law passed by the Iranian parliament to counter sanctions and develop the country's nuclear program. As part of the agreement, Iran said it will voluntarily allow the agency to conduct more verification and monitoring activities in case such activities are needed. After arriving in Vienna, Grossi claimed that the agreement includes access to people of interest.
The Director General of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, has said that there is, quote, great expectations about his ongoing talks with Iranian officials over issues concerning their cooperation. The remarks sent a positive signal on the course of cooperation between the agency and Tehran. That positive assessment was also echoed by Mohammad Islami, head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization.
The Islamic Republic will in no way compromise on its national interests and its national security. These meetings show Tehran and the IAEA maintain a professional relationship based on trust, and that we attach great importance to abiding by the IAEA safeguards.
Islami added that IAEA reports have confirmed that Iran has not enriched uranium beyond 60% and that issues regarding claims that some uranium particles have been found in undeclared sites in Iran have been resolved. Grossi, for his part, said that the discussions are being held in an atmosphere of honesty and cooperation. He insisted that the agency is not a political tool for any country.
The IAEA has not been and will never be a political tool of anybody. I, as Director General, I am independent, I am under no country's instructions, and we act in a way that is very transparent. Member states have a board of governors, every step we take is scrutinized, and I think that what is important is to work together, as the Vice President was saying, work on the cooperation, which is very important, on peaceful uses, work on the observance of the comprehensive safeguard agreements, and all the rest is speculation.
Grossi was also asked by reporters present in the presser to comment on the Israeli regime's total lack of accountability regarding its nuclear weapons program. Grossi said that there are limitations to the agency's inspections of those that have not signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty.
That being said, let me conclude this important question by saying that every country in the world should be a member of the Non-Proliferation Treaty.
The visit appears to have helped improve relations between Iran and the IAEA, particularly scientific and technical collaboration between them. The two officials said that Iran's annual nuclear science conference, which has so far been held on a national level, will be upgraded to an international conference from next year.
Both sides have expressed satisfaction with the talks, and Mr. Grossi himself has called the atmosphere positive, which could pave the way for the revival of the nuclear deal. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
People have staged a sit-in in the Syrian capital, Damascus, calling for an end to the U.S. and Western sanctions on the Arab country. The bans are making life harder for people across the nation, particularly following the recent earthquakes there. Our Syria correspondent Mohammed Ali has more in this report.
Syrian political parties, along with Syria-based Palestinian factions, have gathered in Arnous Square in Damascus, calling on the U.S. and its Western allies to lift economic sanctions on Syria. Speakers said this Western siege on Syria is inhumane and requires urgent actions by the international community, considering that people in Syria are dealing with deteriorating economic conditions following the recent earthquakes.
We express our anger over the unilateral sanctions imposed by the U.S. and its allies. Syrians suffered a lot as a result of such unjust and inhumane actions. Not lifting them is a crime against humanity. We call on the U.N. to shoulder its responsibilities and try to get such sanctions lifted.
We reiterate our support for Syria and reject the unjust seizure act, which led to shortages in basic needs. We call on the U.S. to stop looting Syria's resources and get out of the Arab country. We also call on Arab and Islamic nations to stand beside Syrians dealing with crises. We call on the Arab League to give Syria's seat back to the country.
Participants raised Syrian and Palestinian flags as well as banners asking for an end to the decades-long bans that have deprived them of their basic needs and resulted in a surge of food and medicine prices.
This is an unjust siege. We as Syrians are suffering from this siege in all aspects of our daily lives, starting from transportation, because the bans have caused a lack of fuel as well as shortage in medicine and also high food prices. All that is because of the imperial blockade.
Life changed so much following the sanctions. Prices went high. People are searching for their basic needs. This siege caused a shortage of so many basic commodities. We call on the world to do something and help us.
The recent earthquakes have further worsened the already deteriorating economic and humanitarian situation in Syria. The UN says even before the earthquake tragedy, 70% of the population needed humanitarian assistance due to the war on the country. One challenge after another, Syrians endured so many hardships in the past decade that made living a normal life a daily challenge. U.S. and EU sanctions exacerbated their suffering, and they demand an end to such injustice. Hamad Ali, Damascus.
Now more than 200,000 people rally across Israel for the ninth straight week against the policies of new Israeli far-right cabinet. The protests turned violent in Tel Aviv. Israeli forces fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse the demonstrators. They also blocked some streets in an attempt to contain the rally. The protesters are angry at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's proposed judicial reforms. If approved, the legislation would increase the cabinet's influence in choosing judges and limit the powers of the Supreme Court to overturn the cabinet's decisions. Critics argue that the legal changes will foster corruption and bring diplomatic isolation. The reforms are the cornerstone of Netanyahu's cabinet, an alliance of ultra-Orthodox and extreme right parties, which took office in late December. Over the years, the Israeli regime has put restrictions on Palestinian access to agricultural lands and water resources in the besieged Gaza Strip. But despite all these cruel measures, some Palestinian farmers have found unique ways to thrive and overcome the status quo. Ola Al-Assi has more for us in her report.
Farming is a fundamental part of the Palestinian identity and history. deeply rooted in the culture of land and the struggle for freedom. After decades of Israeli occupation, organic farming has weakened significantly. Now, Palestinian farmers are finding new ways to revive the economy and maintain their heritage through innovative, sustainable farming methods. We spoke to Aid Abu Ramadan, who's one of the pioneers of vertical farming.
I'm actually a civil engineer, but I have inherited this passion for agriculture from my father and grandfather. Actually, due to the Israeli occupation and the agricultural land is shrinking every day, so it came to my mind that we need to plant something that gives more per unit of land. So I was thinking of intensive agriculture as well as vertical agriculture.
Abu Ramadan is optimistic about the success of the project. He emphasizes the need of vertical farming as a means for Palestinian farmers to show resistance against Israeli violations.
This model of vertical agriculture is the first model in Palestine. It's an experiment, but it looks really promising. I hope that we will continue with vertical and intensive agriculture in order to help our Palestinian farmers. But first, we need the know-how, we need the technology, we need the knowledge to bring to them. Because we know that vertical and intensive agriculture is the future for Palestinian farmers.
Palestinian farming is suffocating under the Israeli occupation, with its two basic resources of land and water legally controlled. The Israeli violations have increased unemployment and poverty rates in Palestine and exacerbated the already dire humanitarian situation.
Israeli violations against the Palestinian agriculture include firing at farmers, leveling agricultural land in the area around the fence, preventing farmers from working in their fields, aerial spraying of herbicides along Gaza's perimeter fence, and dumping of farmers' land in eastern Gaza. The Israeli occupation has placed bans on exports of agricultural goods from the besieged Gaza enclave. The regime imposes impossible conditions on Gazans' farmers with the intention of decreasing the quality of the Palestinian product and reducing their marketability abroad. Furthermore, Israel denies entry of the agricultural equipment and certain fertilizers.
Israeli occupation is not simply limited to harming civilian population, damaging buildings and infrastructure. It's fundamentally aimed to destroy the Palestinian lands and environment in order to put pressure on the Palestinians in the Gaza Strip and cut their links with the motherland. Al-Asi, Gaza.
Turning elsewhere, China's military budget has risen by 7.2% this year, slightly outpacing last year's increase. The national budget released on Sunday showed some $224 billion has been allocated to military spending for the year 2023. Beijing says armed forces should work to carry out military operations, boost combat preparedness, and enhance their military capabilities. This year's hike in defense spending marks the eighth consecutive single-digit increase. The upswing in the defense budget comes amid growing tensions between Beijing and Washington over a wide range of issues, including Taiwan and the South China Sea. Political analyst Angelo Giolano says China's increase in defense spending is quite rational, given the rise in the defense budgets of Japan and the U.S., both Taiwan's allies.
I think this increase is a non-issue. Just to remind you, there's the GDP increase for 2023 will be 6%. So now you have, in comparison, you have a 7.2% of increase for defense spending. I think it is marginal. What worries me more is actually what Japan is doing. Japan is aiming to spend double what it is spending right now in defense spending by 2027. That is a much more relevant news, especially since Japan is positioning itself to be extremely aggressive. Japan declared that what Japan did was to reinterpret their Pacific Constitution. Additional to that, they say that if if Taiwan was to be attacked, well, Taiwan as an ally would be defended. So I think that is the real news. When it comes to defense spending, I think China is very rational. I think also you need to compare to the U.S. Right now, China is spending one quarter of what the U.S. is spending. If you were to adjust this into power parity, purchase power parity, it would be about half what the U.S. is spending.
Women in Afghanistan are still deprived of education, while the country's Ministry of Higher Education recently announced the beginning of the new academic year for male students. Female students are desperate, yet hopeful, that someday they might step into universities and schools again.
The Ministry of Higher Education in Afghanistan has recently announced the start of the new academic year for male students only. It begins on March 6. This is while there is still no mention of when and if education would be accessible to girls in the country again. People believe women must enjoy their right to education.
It is a famous saying that women make half of the society. So if half of the society gets excluded from education, it will result in mass illiteracy in the future across the nation. Also, it will increase poverty, migration, and despair among the population. We hope authorities will reopen high schools and universities soon.
Female students are worried about not being allowed to attend high school and universities. They say the ban on their education has negative effects on the fate and future of millions of Afghan girls and the country.
When half of the society is left uneducated, we could say that half of the country is paralyzed, that the country wouldn't be able to prosper properly. On the other hand, today's girls are tomorrow's mothers, and not well-educated mother faces many more difficulties when raising the future generation. The future also lies in their hands.
We definitely wish that in the new solar year we would step into universities again. Education is our right, and we hope to enjoy our right as soon as possible.
The education ban for females started days after the Taliban took power in Afghanistan in 2021. At first, students were banned from attending high school. Then, 2 months ago, a decree issued by the Ministry of Higher Education banned female students from universities too. The decree said the ban would be temporary. Millions of Afghans, and not just women, have pinned their hopes on that sentence, which says the ban would not be permanent. They wish to see schools and universities will open again soon, yet no one knows when that limitation will be lifted. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
And that report wraps up World News for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
Back to Aperture, everyone. In the first part of the documentary, we met the hidden victims of America's multi-billion dollar chemical industry. By offering an excellent wage and a comfortable retirement package, chemical giants Dow Chemical and DuPont factories are welcome wherever they go. For many of the town's residents, a job at Dow Chemical or DuPont marks the beginning of a very glimmering future. Yet, victims like Alice, Kenton, and Rukna have seen the ugly truth behind this prosperity. Don't go away. Here's the rest of our program.
850 children are now registered at Rashida B's center. In 2015, Dow gave $4.5 billion to its shareholders, but not a single cent has been given to the decontamination of Bhopal. For weeks, we tried to reach the communications department at Dow to get an interview, without success.
The water that people drink.
Who's going to answer those questions? It's really important.
I'm not aware of who that is right off the top of my head. We have 50,000 employees, so I'll have to do some research.
Dow never called us back, so we decided to go to the company's General Assembly in Midland, in the U.S., to ask our questions. A few days later, we finally received an email from Dow. The company laments, "Bhopal was a terrible tragedy that we will never forget." But they relieved themselves of all responsibility, stating that, "We acquired Union Carbide more than 16 years after the catastrophe of 1984.
Dow continues to address global issues through human solutions. Issues like clean water, as important as life itself. Dow is working to make water safe and readily available to people all over the globe. The human element. Nothing is more fundamental. Nothing more elemental."
In Dow's wake, countless victims and human tragedies pile up without any damage to the company's profits. In December 2015, Dow announced the biggest financial operation in its history. A merger of $130 billion with another American chemical giant, DuPont. A match made in heaven.
You and DuPont, there's a lot of good chemistry between us.
DuPont made its fortune with dynamite.
Dynamite!
Nylon. And Teflon. The magical material that prevents food from sticking to pans. However, behind the success of Teflon, DuPont hides a dark secret.
I just can't believe that DuPont, the money means more than people.
There's people dying because of what they've done.
DuPont knew years ago what they were doing.
At best, it's despicable. At the worst, it's criminal.
At the heart of this drama is one city, Parkersburg. Lost in the eastern U.S. The city was built around the DuPont factory. Suzanne Bailey came here in 1978 to work on the Teflon production lines.
I went to work in May the 8th, 1978. That was my glorious day, right there. They took our pictures.
It's you?
That's me, without gray hair.
In the middle?
Yep. You know, I was so happy.
You're smiling.
I was. That was the elite job. I mean, everybody wanted to go there because for the money, for the benefits, and everything like that. It was secure.
The chemical industry is a growing one, growing by leaps and bounds.
I mean, you could just mention the DuPont name and doors swung open. It was like princes coming through the door, you know?
Yes, in such an environment, you can look to a bright future with confidence and optimism.
Were you happy, so?
I was thrilled. I was absolutely thrilled to death.
A few months after starting her job at DuPont, Suzanne Bailey became pregnant In January of 1981, she gives birth to little Bucky.
When he was born, it was very traumatic. They didn't know what to do with him. They'd never seen anything like it. I could not figure out what happened. He had half a nostril, half a nose. The eye is a keyhole pupil. I didn't know what to do. I was afraid he was going to die in my arms. I had no idea what was wrong.
Bucky survived. He is now 35 years old. But his childhood was spent between his home and the hospital.
I had 30 surgeries in a span of, you know, 6 to 7 years, where they took rib cartilage to form my nose. I have a metal plate here. They stretched my forehead out so that they could use that skin and bring it down and mold my nose here. I still only have one nostril, functioning nostril.
We had to put the hockey mask on him and the guards because he wasn't allowed to touch his face.
For how long?
He had to wear those for, I would say, 3 months, 4 months.
It's a long time.
Yeah, the only way that he got to take him off was just to eat.
How is it as a kid to grow up and to have, you know, so many surgeries? And I mean, it's pretty intense, you know.
Walking out in public and going into a store or a restaurant, and as soon as you enter, all the eyes are on you. And school, when you go in and you're trying to make new friends, all they see is you're different.
After her maternity leave, Suzanne Bailey began to suspect her job as the cause of Bucky's deformities. A mysterious source tips her off to one molecule in particular, C8, the molecule in Teflon that stops food from sticking to pans.
When I went back to work the first day, I went to the locker and I found the paper laying there. I picked it up and I began reading about it. It was talking about how the rats were fed the C8 and what deformities that it had around their face. And I thought, that sounds just like Bucky.
It was very similar to what Bucky had.
Absolutely. Very similar, almost identical to what he had. That's why I knew that there was something wrong. That's why I connect.
The scientific study Suzanne Bailey found had been conducted by a subcontractor of DuPont. It studied baby rats whose mothers were exposed to C8. They developed abnormal eye lenses.
I immediately walked out that door, went down to medical, and I said, is this what's wrong with my baby? Oh, no, no, no. Nothing on this planet will hurt you. That was the motto. That's what they always say.
Yeah.
Nothing here will hurt you.
But in the meantime, DuPont was secretly investigating the pregnant women working in their factory. 2 out of 7 children born to the factory workers had facial deformities like Bucky. Shortly after, DuPont decided to transfer Suzanne Bailey and her colleagues to other departments. At the time, Kenton Wamsley also worked in the manufacturing department of Teflon. He remembers the discussion he had with his manager.
He said, Ken, we sent all the women home out of Teflon, all of them. He said, oh, don't worry. It won't hurt the men, just the women. We feel that it can cause trouble. So I thought, won't hurt me.
Kenton Wamsley was a lab technician. He handled C8 for 30 years.
Breathe the fumes from them, all the samples we breathe. But we just, you know, at the time, we thought DuPont would take care of us. And so I just did my jobs for years and years, you know. And we didn't realize it. Our health was an issue then. Surgeon diagnosed me as having cancer. He had to take all my rectum, part of my colon.
They're giving you that for every 5 years. Just savings.
Now Kenton Wamsley has to live with an ostomy bag attached to his stomach. He changes it day and night. At the factory, he worked in a team with three other technicians.
My buddies, people I really love, seen them every day, cared about them. Those guys are all dead, and I should have been. They didn't even see retirement. None of them.
Wamsley and his colleagues were never warned about the risks of C8. However, we procured a confidential document from DuPont. It's dated 1982, 34 years ago. In it, Mr. Rector at the time expresses concern about the consequences of C8 retained in the blood of employees. He specifically recommends that practical steps be taken to reduce this exposure.
All employees, not just Teflon area workers, are exposed. So rather than to do anything, they just wrote it out. I've never seen a letter like that. I'm mad. You can see why. We could have prevented a lot of lies if they would have told us there was a problem. Why'd they cover it up? Why'd they lie? Why didn't they have us protected? Too costly?
We tracked down Bruce Carr, DuPont's former medical director. He is now enjoying a peaceful retirement by the ocean, far from Parkersburg.
I have a document of 1982 showing that you were aware that C8 was toxic for workers. Why have you not told them the truth at that time?
They were all told the truth. They were told everything we knew at the time.
Actually, no. I have interviewed some employees and they were not aware of anything.
We told employees everything we knew as soon as we knew it. If you go back to 1982, you're trying to do reconstructionist history, and you can't do that.
Why have you not protected your employees? Il a raccroché.
DuPont would not only put their employees in danger. Once again, tens of thousands of people would be affected. They live up to 70 kilometers away from the factory. One man would discover this, a bit by accident. Joe Kiger. On October 31st, 2000, he receives a letter from the municipality concerning the quality of the tap water. It mentions C8.
I was sitting in my courtyard, and the wife was watering the flowers, and we got our water bill in the mail, and with that bill came a letter. It's like you get form letters all the time. So you look and say, oh, okay, bang, you put it over and you don't think about it. Next thing you know, you throw it away. And that's basically what this was. It just caught my attention, and I started reading through it, and then the flag started popping up. First of all, what was C8 here, mm-hmm. which is used by DuPont Works? Well, what's DuPont have to do with our water?
Joe Kiger sought clarification on the matter.
I called DuPont to try to find out. So they put me in touch with a guy, named Mr. Kennedy. And I said, you know, I'd like to know more about this C8 issue. He just told me it's nothing to worry about. About it was just a byproduct of Teflon, and it wasn't anything to worry about. And he was flat out lying to me. I could tell that.
To get to the bottom of it, he takes DuPont to court. After a long legal battle, the judge forces the company to declassify their internal studies on C8. Joe Kiger discovers the truth behind the factory at Parkersburg. For decades, they've been dumping C8 waste into the river. To make things worse, DuPont has known since 1984 that the molecule spread into the region's tap water. The company found astronomical levels in public taps, up to 50 times the limit of toxicity, according to the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency.
That was 1984, and we didn't come out till 2000.
So with it. 16 years.
Yeah, before we even hit them up about it. And they chose, as you see right here, they chose not to do anything about it. And they knew what was coming with the liabilities if they got caught. They were trying to slide under the radar. People trusted DuPont for so long. They have done nothing but lie for years to people about what this stuff's all about. There's sick people out here because of what they've done. There's people dying because of what they've done.
During all these years, more than 70,000 people have been drinking contaminated water. In 2011, both scientific research and the U.S. justice system established that C8 could cause six diseases: thyroid disorder, high cholesterol, ulcerative colitis, high blood pressure, kidney cancer, or testicular cancer. Today, 3,500 people in the Parkersburg region are ill. They've all filed complaints against DuPont. This is the case for Earl and Gwen Botkin.
I've had ulcerative colitis for about 17 years, and it's about killed me a couple times. I still have thyroid problem, and I have high cholesterol. And those are all associated with C8.
Today, Earl Botkin doesn't have a colon anymore. He, too, is living with an ostomy bag.
So all of a sudden, you don't function normally, but you have your bowel movement on your side. And that's what I live with until I die. And there's not any hope of that's going to change. It controls where I go, what I do, and what I eat. And just controls a lot of things in my life. But anyway, I lived through that.
A document reveals that all of these victims could have been spared. On May 22, 1984, a meeting took place at the DuPont headquarters. The directors are worried about the consequences for the inhabitants. They plan to eliminate all C8 emissions.
I wanted to show you these sentences here.
But finally, no measures are taken. Their argument: it's not economically attractive.
That was in what year?
84. That's before we were married. That's a long time ago. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Long, long time ago.
That's crazy. That's what makes it so bad, you know, that they had evidence all along and just disregarded it and kept doing what they were doing.
It was company greed that caused this whole situation. They knew what they were doing to us, and they continued to do it before money. That's the only reason they continue to do it.
DuPont refuses to collectively compensate the 3,500 sick people. They prefer to study the cases one by one. As a result, since 2012, only one victim has been able to get a trial. DuPont was sentenced to pay her $1.6 million. The 3,499 remaining victims, like Earl Botkin, are still waiting. At the current pace of the trials, the last one would take place in 100 years.
Do you still trust and you're still confident that you will get a trial at some point?
Oh.
She lives long enough.
If I live to be 150, I might. There will be a trial someday. But the chances of me living long enough to ever see that are probably slim to none. But we're just another document. A number of cases to be tried. DuPont has made billions of dollars. I think they should stand up to what they've done and make it right with the people they've made sick.
DuPont refused all of our requests for an interview, so we drove to their headquarters in Delaware on the East Coast to convince them to answer our questions. At the other end of the line, we reach the head of media relations, Daniel Turner.
We are doing a documentary piece. The best way is, you know, we meet and to make a proper interview, you know, at some point. But first, let's meet. You know, I'm just here.
We'll respectfully decline the on-camera interview. I will provide you with a statement.
You know, there is like an incredible amount of documents showing that you have known at DuPont for the past 30 years that C8 was toxic, and you know that you were poisoning your employees at the Washington Works plant and the Parkersburg citizen. Why are you not recognizing the fact that you have deliberately poisoned thousands of persons?
Okay, so are those the questions you're asking?
Yeah, this is my questions.
Okay, I'll be happy to provide with our statement.
Today, we are in 2016. There are still 3,500 persons with severe disease that are waiting to just have the right to get a trial. I mean, for how long are you going to deny your responsibility? Are you waiting that they all die?
So, we will provide you with a statement for your peace.
Nothing else? No?
Like I said, we will provide you with a statement. Thanks so much. Have a good day. Bye.
Bye.
We did receive a press release from DuPont, but without a single word for the victims. They claim to have studied C8 carefully for decades and affirm to have always acted responsibly. In 2015, DuPont finally stopped using C8. The company was also ordered by the courts to clean up the region. But how many generations are still to experience the after effects of this contamination? In the chemical world, history inexorably tends to repeat itself. It takes decades to reveal the truth, and just as many years for the multinationals to be prosecuted. In their laboratories, new toxic molecules are constantly being developed. But in 10, 20, 30, or 40 years, who knows how many new victims will be poisoned?
Merged together, Dow Chemical and DuPont create the world's largest chemical company in terms of sales. Yet, the victims' testimonies, those whose lives have been poisoned, will forever cast a shadow over this industry as they fight in the hope that someday their culprits will be brought to justice. And that's it for this week, everyone. Join us next time for another documentary. It's goodbye.
Radio, a window to peace of mind and spirituality. You can tune in to RIB English Radio 24 hours a day. We are with you. Are you with us? Are you with us? Are you with us? This is our voice from the heart of the Islamic Republic of Iran, RIB English Radio.
This is for a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. This is for a better life from IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Sayyid Mahdi Tawakkol. I am at your service to talk about another strategy that helps us enjoy a more appropriate life based on the concepts of the Quran and Islamic narrations. Today I want to talk about giving charity to needy and destitute people. There is a vast discussion about the realm of charity regarding how much we should donate, to whom we should give money, the conditions related to it, for example, the charity is better to be done secretly or publicly, the divine rewards of it, and many other related issues. But for today, I try to only focus on a general concept of charity. Maybe I have another fortune to talk about this subject. Charity in general has both individual and social benefits. It also has a significant positive effect of man's material and spiritual life. In Islam, charity or as-sadaqah only can attract divine reward if it is done with the intention of seeking closeness to Allah, which is called in Arabic terminology al-qastul qurbah. Charity and giving alms in Islam is sometimes obligatory, like zakat and khums, and sometimes recommended, like all kind of donation that is paid in the way of Allah, be it in the form of giving money to a destitute man or a diseased man who needs help, we help him to be cured. And in some cases, it has a general aspect like building hospitals and orphanages and etc. Orphanages and the like. Imam Ali, in one of his noble sayings, interprets charity as a healing medicine and says, As-sadaqatu dawa'un munjih. The word dawa means medicine, and the word munjih means effective and healing. So he says charity is like an effective and healing medicine. As I will describe, this narration says that charity is a cure for both individual and social diseases. And by diseases here, the Imam refers to the problems people have. We have seen in many cases that by donation, many deprived patients are treated, they are cured, orphans are taken care of, and the pains of the poor are soothed. For instance, if a natural disaster like an earthquake or vast fire happens somewhere, humanitarian donations or financial donations is the most useful thing that does the job. This aid is nothing but a vast wealth that is gathered by charity givers. The aid provided by organizations such as the World Red Cross or UNICEF is largely dependent on these people's contributions. Just imagine if every neighbor think about his own neighbor, or the worshippers who go to the mosque to pray are aware of each other's financial and other problems and try to help those who need. If a family thinks about other families or their close relatives, if a friend thinks about the need of his own friends, then such a society is very unlikely to have serious financial problems. For example, today my friend has taken a loan or is in a debt to someone and does not have enough money to settle it and to return the money back, so I try to help him. The next day I may be in financial problem and my friend will help me. This is a real deal that we could have in our normal life in a society. This is what Imam Ali says in one of his noble sayings, and pointed to his saying that introduced charity as dawa'un munjih, that he mentioned this narration, which means that charity is like a healing medicine. In a broader view, charity has got a spiritual effect, which means that by charity or as sadaqah, giving sadaqah, God will remove many calamities from man's life. As it is narrated from the Prophet to have said, "Dawu maldakum bisadaqah wa ruddu abwab al-bala'i bid-du'a." Treat your sick with charity and close the doors of calamity with asking Allah by praying. Experience also has shown that giving charity is very effective for treating patients. Charity giving is so important in Islam that a portion of man's property is obligatory to be extracted and be spent on the expenses that is described in Islamic laws, and this portion is zakat and khums. Even in the Quran, charity is usually mentioned next to the payer. This verse we have heard it a lot, Aqamu Salata wa Atu Zakat. Aqamu Salat means to perform prayer, and next to it is often the sentence wa Atu Zakat, that means those who give alms. Mentioning the prayer next to giving alms means that to the same degree that man should have a relationship with Allah by saying the prayer, he should also maintain his relationship with God's servants through financial aid and giving charity. Let's take a break, and I will be back soon.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
A society where its people are attentive to each other's problems and try to solve them, this society is strong, united, and powerful. In such a society, people's hearts are tied together, kindness prevails, and people enjoy more peace and calmness. As a result, the people of this society can worship God more. They can be obedient more easily because their minds are less involved in worldly problems. More importantly, there is no doubt that such a society will be exposed to the mercy of the merciful God because they are more attentive and more prone to worship Allah because their mind is less entangled with worldly matters. As a result, Allah will have more mercy on the individuals in that society. A significant part of the problems that exist in a society is due to financial problems. If everyone tries to solve this problem in his own turn, a large part of human problems will be solved. If the spirit of charity and humanitarian aid spreads in a society, the price of goods will become cheaper, many worries for the future will disappear, and some of the high prices will be reduced. But if the money remains stagnant, for example, in the form of treasures in one's house, every individual houses, or in people's bank account without being used or, what to say, without being included in the economic cycle of the society, it ends in many forms of social problems. That also it will affect personal life of people, those people who are going to gather more money. Even though they have a lot of money, but eventually they should spend, on the other hand, more money as well. And in such a society that people are more attentive to gather more and more, the poverty line is getting higher and higher. With this explanation, it becomes more clear why charity is described as a saving and healing medicine in what Imam Ali said in his short sayings. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Every grain of sand in every desert land, he knows. Every shade of palm, every closed hand, he knows. Every sparkling tear on every eyelash, he knows. Every thought I have and every word I share, he knows.
IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.